And there was one woman in the middle of the room. It was like she was following my eyes, because as soon as I would come to her, she would start doing a little jig, like an Irish jig, like a little river dance for me to see. And only I could see it. So I can't even, like, it's not even a heckle. It was a silent heckle, you know? It was like a kind of a racist mime. I still think of that.
Hello, welcome to Comedy with an Accent podcast. I'm your Taiwanese comedian, Quan Wen. I interview comedians who perform English stand-up comedy but who are not native English speakers, or they can have a very distinct British regional accent. This podcast is all about comedy, about accent, about languages, and about the comedy technique. So stay tuned if you're interested. Hello, welcome back to another episode of Comedy with an Accent podcast. Today, I'm breaking into a new direction. I'm breaking the mold. When I started the podcast, I say I'm going to find a comedian whose native tongues are not English. And then just thought how small that pool is in the UK. I said I will also find some British comedian with quite distinct accents. Now, here's a problem. The comedian I'm having today is kind of an English native speaker, but millions of people will kill me if I were to describe him as a as a British comedian. We are having our very first guest from Ireland, more specifically from the Republic of Ireland. And my guest today is Peter Flanagan. Hello, Peter.
Dia Gwit Quan Wen. Konosatotu.
Was that a fair description of the difficulty I find myself in?
It's very difficult for you. You know, you're trying to You're trying to please a lot of people. There's a lot of people to offend
right. On
both sides of the argument. So you're doing a good job.
Obviously, Irish accents are celebrated and famous for its sing-songy nature. And people say, how. And there's a running gag. So I've seen at least 3 to 4 male Irish comedians doing the same line about how sexy Irishman comes across
right. With
their accent.
Yeah.
But as a matter of fact, when it comes to dating, it's probably not a very good choice, putting the accent aside.
Well, I mean, we're having a moment, I think, the kind of Paul Mescalification of women's sexuality, I think is...
I think it started before. I always call him Paul Mescal.
I say Paul Mescal, but right. I honestly am not sure how to pronounce a second name. It's not that common a name in Ireland.
I think the world sort of fantasizing about Irishmen started a little bit earlier.
When would you date it?
Barry Keoghan. No, no.
I think it's Boyzone / Westlife, I think.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of women were kind of exposed to Westlife at a young age, and they were warped. You know, it changed their sexuality forever. They were exposed to Westlife at too young an age.
Is Boyzone fully Irish?
Boyzone are fully Irish.
All 5 of them?
Yeah, you could measure their skulls. It's Irish. They're Irish.
Skull, but you're saying the stereotype about Irish people having a big head. Is that where you're going?
No, I didn't say that. But if you...
Okay, we're driving too far. Let me explain what's going on here. I thought about inviting an Irish comedian for a very long time. However, Irish comedians in the UK are slightly different from the different guests I've had so far. For the other country, you had 1 or 2 at best. Irish comedy in the UK is a genre. I don't know whether that description is fair. I don't want to say it, but there are so many of you. So, which is also good because it represents the diversity of Irish comedian. Not all of them are alike. So I feel when I choose my guests, I need to make a point. As in, why out of all this, tons of Irish guests in the UK, I select the specific guest to come and talk about the relationship between comedy and accents in particular. And I invited Peter today because I don't think it's a secret identity outside comedy. Peter is a writer for Irish Times.
On occasion.
On occasion. Actually, yeah. One of the writers, because when I Google Peter Flanagan Irish Time, one job title came out and it's assistant business editor. And I thought Peter studied philosophy and politics. I don't know. He had a thing into business. Turns out it wasn't.
That's a different Peter Flanagan.
Yeah, a much thicker chin. But that's not fashion describing today. So Peter has very specific. I think you have a talent, a way with words, and you put into use in slightly different way when you do your comedy and when you do writing.
Sure.
And now how you manage your social media. But putting that all aside, I'm going to come to my usual question for all my guests. That is, Peter, do you think you have an accent when you speak English?
I do.
You do?
For sure.
Is it a strong accent or a mild accent?
Depends who you ask. So I think a lot of people who know me would say I have a strong Irish accent. But then I speak to other people who are kind of upset by my accent. They think it's not Irish enough. I've had people come up to me after shows saying, why do you have an American accent? Why do you sound American? You know, my accent can really bother people, actually.
Right. So those two camps, one thing your accent's strong, the other thing is not strong enough. Is it fair to say that they are British and Irish people evenly distributed, or is one side more strongly British, the other side more strongly Irish?
It can be both. I've had Irish people complain that I don't sound Irish enough, you know. And within Ireland, people would say I have a Dublin accent, which again irritates people because I'm not from Dublin, so they feel, you know. In Ireland, people are very defensive. There's a policing of accents that goes on within Ireland. But then, to my surprise, when I leave Ireland, sometimes people don't feel... Sometimes I get a backhanded compliment. So I've had people come up to me and go, wow, I can understand what you're saying and you're Irish, or you speak so well for an Irish person, you know? I think I probably...
Such a British thing.
Yeah, they think they're giving me a compliment, you know? But
Can I interrupt here? So are Dublin accents hated? Like, are Dubliners hated in the Republic of Ireland?
I wouldn't say they're hated, but there's definitely... So historically... When the Normans invaded Ireland, their stronghold was Dublin. For centuries, Dublin and the outskirts of Dublin was the strongest. It's where British power was centralized,
right,
around an area called the Pale. So even culturally today, there's still this kind of
collaborators.
They were. I mean, I guess you could call them collaborators,
or
but
surrender a bit too easily compared to
that's where British rule was strongest.
No, that's Belfast.
Well, that's we can talk about Northern.
We can't.
There's 800 years. There's 800 years here. We can
no,
go through.
You started Irish historic lessons. I'm just joking.
Long story short, Dublin is considered the most British part of the Republic of Ireland, at least.
Like Edinburgh in Scotland.
Sure.
All I have to explain, Peter is from the county of Kildare.
That's right.
Is it fair to say it's kind of like home county-ish distance?
Sure, I think that's fair. Yeah.
But
yeah,
not quite as rich.
I mean, it depends where you go. Depends who you ask as well. I live just outside of a town that was very poor, and in the last number of years it's become, I guess you would say, gentrified. It's become kind of like a commuter town to Dublin.
We were talking about some people finding your accent strong, some people finding your accent not strong enough.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not just one accent from Ireland. There's a generic Irish accent people think they know. For example, they tend not to pronounce the TH sound as th or th. You say thank you instead of thank you.
Sure.
Because I had an Irish colleague when I was working in an American tech company. And I remember joking about, oh, so this for that is the same as tit for tat. And she didn't find it hilarious. And if you're from the south of Ireland, like from Cork, it's a much more animated and much more sing-songy. Peter is from outside the Dublin area. And in a podcast you did with Daniel Morgleton, you've actually said that your accent is not strong enough for some audience and you feel like you shortchanged them.
I've had that. Some people are irritated that my accent is a little bit...
Because what they are looking for in a Scottish accent... No. So what they're looking for in Irish accent, when they know the accent from Ireland, they're looking for a live mascot of what they call a paddy, like an Irish paddy.
And yeah.
They want
They'd
to
be thrilled.
Entertain them in a very specific way.
Some audience members, not everybody, but some audience members' ideal comedy night will be like a guy with a guitar, a magician... And then to close things out, maybe an Irishman with a pig under his arm, a thistle in his mouth. Maybe he's got a stick of dynamite in his hand, doing a little dance. For some people, that would be like a great night out.
Has anyone ever done river dance as part of the routine on stage?
No, I've been heckled with river dance, though.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I did a show.
But what can we say? You guys presented one of the best Eurovision.
Thank you. That means a lot.
I regret to say that because some of the audience may be too young to even know the reference I was making. You say that some audience find your accent not strong enough. What kind of hackles do you get from that? Do people request you do certain lines? Do people request you do certain
things? I have had hackles like that saying you sound American or whatever. But the strangest one that I remember is doing a gig down in Bournemouth. And it was a really drunk, staggy crowd. It was in a nightclub. I was on last, so people are very drunk now. Yeah. I've got to do 20 minutes. You know how it is. And I'm just trying to hammer them with punchlines. A little bit of crowd interaction if I have to, just to put somebody down. You know, you're just trying to, you don't want to give them any space to
It's like when the California wildfire season is about to start, you cannot allow any single one of them.
You've got to keep those embers patted down, right?
So whack them all.
I'm doing whack-a-mole. I'm just hammering them with my punchlines. And I'm not giving them space to come at me. and I'm scanning the room. Felt like I was machine gunning them, you know? So I'm looking around the audience, and there was one woman in the middle of the room. It was like she was following my eyes, because as soon as I would come to her, she would start doing a little jig, like an Irish jig, like a little river dance for me to see. And only I could see it. So I can't even, like, it's not even a heckle. It was a silent heckle, you know? It was like a kind of a racist mime. I still think of that. When I think of all the heckles I've had, that was probably the most brutally effective, because I couldn't even address it, really, you know? It was, good for her.
I wonder whether she thought she was being harmless, or it was
she certainly did.
So people can't really accuse others of inventing the word Karen, right? I mean, like, there's no better description of this woman other than Karen. So the Karen was doing a leprechaun-y.
Yeah. There's something terrifying about a late middle-aged British woman who has maybe had her kids. She works in middle management, possibly in a call center or a HR department, or maybe some sort of logistics company in a regional British town, who has a few gin and tonics once a month and decides to go to a comedy club or a disco. If you get in her way, she will destroy you.
I think Karen is not strong enough. It was a Sheila.
She was more of a Sheila.
She was more.
Karen would have complained about my act.
Yes.
Sheila is like, I'm going to complain directly to you right now.
Yeah.
I'm going to disrupt this performance.
At the same time, these people are the bread and butter of why the local comedy clubs can exist. She got into your skin on that occasion. Would you say that?
I'm talking about it years later. So obviously she's inside of me right now. There's part of Sheila that is like one of Voldemort's Horcruxes. I'll never forget her face. Just the kind of, this little jig she was doing. You know?
I feel people incredible. In their 20s or 30s may have to be reminded that, okay, these days no one really makes a distinction between Irish white. Or actually, years ago, the British survey, what's the word?
It's like
a questionnaire.
White other, white Irish.
Yeah, they used to be like white British, white other.
It's still there.
Irish.
It's still there. It depends on the form, but it's, I've seen it.
The racism today based on the Dulles color chart, Irish were the primary group suffering from discrimination. So there will be places like a pub putting on a notice say, no Irish. Some even worse, like no dogs and Irish.
No blacks, no dogs, no Irish.
Yeah, so before non-white minorities like us receive this today, Irish were the practice run.
Yeah.
And some of those mentality would have stayed with people of a certain generation above. And deep down, they still kind of look down on Irish people to an extent.
It's there. I think most people I meet in this country have like a positive disposition towards Irish people.
Because they won the passport.
There's an element of that too. And also, like, there was such mass immigration here in the 50s and 60s and 70s in particular that there's a huge amount of British people that have, like, an Irish granny or some cultural link now, you know. But people generally are very positive, but with some people, there can be a latent hibernophobia, let's say.
So if I'm being lazy, I just ask you very generically, what do you feel as an Irish comedian? Okay, so first, you did the most typical Irish thing. You left Ireland. That's the most Irish thing you could have done.
Sure.
Now, as an Irish comedian based in the UK, what does it feel like to you?
Being an Irish comic in the UK.
How would you word it? How would you describe it?
I feel very fortunate. I mean, you know, it's a great comedy scene here. I think London is whatever career you want to pursue. I mean, this is a great city to do it.
Mm. So I don't know if, I mean, we're going to come into a slightly more political discussion. I don't know whether I can be truly objective looking at this scenario where an Irish comedian is kind of ironically based in the UK. And I have a joke about this. And the joke goes like this. People suggest I should do comedy in Mandarin instead. There's a massive market in China and it'll be a shame if I don't exploit it. I then say, well, I just love my own country too much. So I refuse to act like a cow for my enemy as the customers, because I'm not some Irish comedian that comes to the UK all the time. And I think it's funny, but it's slightly vicious. But I noticed whenever I tell this joke, every single Irish comedian laughed at it rather than feel offended.
Sure.
So first, it's a sign of like Irish people do have that strong sense of humor. You love the crack, right?
Sure.
Secondly, it sounds funny, but it's not quite a direct comparison, because if I were to perform in China in Mandarin, there are certain things I definitely cannot say, mm-hmm. and I cannot poke them the same way Irish act poked at British people for the historical atrocity, for their ignorance when it comes to history, geography. British people still have a certain extent ability to laugh at themselves. They are very self-deprecating. And the same thing cannot be said about Chinese people. But that sort of paradox, do you find it so interesting to explore, or does it frustrate you sometimes?
I mean, I'm not anti-British at all. So for me, there's no contradiction in living and performing here. I do think there are some British people who maybe don't like my stand-up or my viewpoints. So I think sometimes if I say something that...
A cricket club in Kent?
That's a cricket club in Kent. If I ever want to like get across... If I just want to build a scene in like one sentence, a cricket club in Kent, people know exactly where I'm at. They know exactly who's in the audience. They know exactly what I'm dealing with. And it's just like shorthand for I'm performing to a bunch of assholes.
Yeah.
That's the setup to the joke. Cricket club in Kent, it's shorthand for assholes.
This is my panic room tonight. Okay, so you say you don't feel the...
I don't. I don't see any contradiction. I wouldn't want to like return to Ireland just to prove a point and some weird kind of nationalistic point. I'm only going to stay on the soil of my forefathers and never move. I don't agree with
and
that.
And that's why I say beneath the joke surface, it's not quite an accurate comparison, because the British audience wouldn't demand, say you are British, otherwise I would not allow you to perform. So that's not the same. I kind of have to introduce myself as Taiwanese, and there will be Chinese audience that say that, so do you admit you're part of China then? They will request that sort of compliance. So it's not really a like.
No, it isn't. I guess, I mean, I'm sure there's literally millions of Chinese people who maybe don't feel... I mean, you tell me, but I imagine there's probably a lot of Chinese people who just aren't political in that way and would be happy to hear the perspective of a Taiwanese person. But nevertheless, they live in a controlled economy without freedom of speech. So it's a lot easier for me to come to a liberal democracy and speak my mind and tell jokes and write articles.
For now. But that's something to praise about. I mean, there's not all saints, but there are certain positive sides about Britain or the UK. And certainly as a comedian, the circuit is big enough and there are enough outward-looking metropolitan international people. And that's why it's great to perform in London.
Absolutely.
You mentioned on the same podcast when you say that you shortchange the audience, that you didn't meet the expectation of what an Irish act should be. I think you quoted a much stronger Irish accent would be that of Dara O'Brien, for example.
Yeah, well, Dara O'Brien is from Dublin as well, but he has a very kind of soft sort of Terry Wogan style voice. So this kind of it's like it's got an Irish lilt, but it's totally understandable for the common ear, let's say.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the ideal accent for BBC. It's like you can't clearly identify which social class it is because it's Irish and we all kind of sound the same. You can identify did this person go to boarding school or not, did this person go to university or not. But it's not too strong. It's not too Irish, which is kind of the sweet spot. It seems to be what the BBC
wants.
They just
want to be reminded a little bit.
Yeah.
Don't take it for granted and go all in.
That's right.
The BBC principle.
Yeah, Terry Wogan is kind of the idealized Irishman. You know, like he was on the airwaves when the IRA bombing campaign was going on in the UK. And he had to go on the BBC with his Irish accent and speak to the people. So he was like the inoffensive face of Ireland for decades.
But Sir Terry Wogan.
That's right. Give him his full title.
Is the Irish example. But in a way, he also reflects the paradox of being an Irishman in the UK because he's gone full British.
Like, yeah.
The way he displays...
he's gone full British.
No,
he's gone full Brit.
In his last few years of presenting... in case people don't know, Terry Wogan was the UK commentator for Eurovision Song Contest for over 30 years.
On the BBC,
and
yeah.
In the 2000s, in the last few years he was doing it, the kind of blatant xenophobia and Euroscepticism he displayed... It was really funny for the very traditional Little Englanders, but the fact is he himself is Irish, and modern Ireland embrace the European Union, embrace the future of Europe, because Europe offers you a way. Now, I don't want to say Europe, continental Europe. I don't want to use the British term. Continental Europe offer you a way out of the dominance of the UK.
For sure.
Yeah, and for what he display, and I thought there's so much irony in that.
Mm.
His Irishman has gone fully native.
You could be right about that. I don't know if I listened to him the last... I'm not like an avid Eurovision guy anymore. I certainly was when I was a kid. I always took Terry Wogan as having kind of an ironic, whimsical attitude towards the competition. I never felt like he was being xenophobic as much as he was like taking the piss out of what's quite a frivolous song competition at times. But you're right. I mean, there's a lot of Irish people for whom it would not be socially acceptable to take a knighthood, you know, whereas he was like, gimme, gimme, gimme. He was very happy, you know.
The little pet on the shoulder by the British royal family.
Yeah.
Ooh, carry out.
He was okay with it. He was okay with it. I think good for him, you know.
I find your writing, I really loved it. The job of a comedian is first to be funny. Being analytical is a plus, but it's not a must. You write for Irish Times. You're like a diaspora. And then you display the analytical side, your way with words for it, but you then insert humor. And it reminds me heavily of Marina Hyde from The Guardian.
Yeah, yeah,
it's the same stuff. Because getting a comedian to write a column is not always a good idea. Stuart Lee's column is a bit of car crash on The Guardian. Maybe I just don't get him. And who's the guy? Adrian Charles is another.
Adrian Charles. I don't know if he's a stand-up though, right? I think he writes kind of light relief pieces.
Yeah. And I still find David Mitchell tried to come across too smart. Mm-hmm. But when you shift from your stand-up to your writing, the role reverses. So you want to make a point and you analyze your argument first. And occasionally, the humor will come into play.
Sure.
I'm going to make some noises and quote some examples.
Oh, great.
Yes. So here, Peter wrote, you describe the British attitudes towards their history of colonization akin to how people view their parents' sex life. They know it happened, but they just don't want to know the details of it. There's a little bit of sense of humor here, but the important thing is for you to make this observation rather than being funny first. I noticed this when you mentioned on Daniel Morgan's podcast, sometimes you will have funny ideas, but you realize not all of them will work or they will dwell well in your comedy set.
Mm-hmm.
And you found that in writing, there's another outlet for you to use or recycle or exploit these ideas.
Yeah. Well, I think my background in stand-up is like club comedy. I would say I'm probably a club comic.
Thank you for saying that, because I don't want to say it, but it has to be said at some point. So
for any listeners who aren't like, and especially in British stand-up, there's often like two, which is like club comedy, and then there's the more narrative, theater-influenced kind of one-man show that'll do well at the Edinburgh Fringe, for example. And very often, comics pick one route or the other. I've always done clubs. I've always enjoyed club sets. But the nature of a club set is it's got to be very punchy, and you don't get a lot of time to stretch your legs in the way that you would over the course
of an
hour.
There's only so much time you can use to explain nuances, because if you do it too much, you lose the gag rate you're supposed to have performing at a weekend comedy club.
Yeah, exactly right. So I think with writing an article like that, and I think this is true and often in social media, with club stand-up, it's got to be a sucker punch. You've got to punch them in the gut and get a laugh. And you've got to make a room full of strangers who haven't paid to see you specifically laugh. And you got to kick them and shock them and shake them. The standard for the funny is way different when you're reading an article on your phone or if you're looking at a meme or an Instagram reel. They're not belly laughing very often.
They're witty.
Yeah. You're just like, oh, this resonates. This has put a smile on my face. And I'm going to send this to my friend because this resonates and it'll resonate with my friend. But it's not like a stand-up joke that gets this big guttural punch. Mm. But there is more to humor. There's more to writing than just that very specific goal of a stand-up joke. There's other ways to get an idea across. And I've been able to do that with my writing, I suppose.
So let's say, for example, you were describing the difficult Brexit negotiation and the UK had the illusion that Ireland would want to leave the EU's customs union and join. And you say that this is like Britain being the drunk ex that texts you, shall we get back together at 1 a.m.?
Right.
And that is from a quite out there political commentator down to I'm another everyday man. I know exactly what you think. I told you the journalistic point I was trying to make. Here I'm using your language to get you up to speed. So my question is, on the other side, when you do stand up, do you have any urge or any desire, any plan to use your journalistic writing, or there's a point you're trying to make so people can understand what the Irishmen think more, or you feel like the weekend club environment is so specific that if it comes across fine, but they cannot be one of the key aim. I don't know how to put it. So I've long had this thought, I want to talk about my home country because it's so small and so few people know about it. And gradually, I give up trying to do that. I would do that in a one-man show. I'll do that at a festival. If I'm doing a comedy set, I kind of remove it from my perspective. It's just too difficult. I can't do some, but even if I talk about my country, it will be such a shallow level that there's not much difference.
I guess the average person...
And they come to the show after a long day. They just want to be entertained. They just want to laugh. They don't want to be educated sometimes.
Sure. I think if you can find a way to do it through a joke, great. But that's very hard. And also for a joke to work, everybody has to buy into the premise. Everybody has to understand the premise in order for the punchline to work. And I guess I have found this difficulty talking about Ireland's relationship with Britain. British people in general just about get it. They've just enough surface understanding.
They just about get it. What do you mean by that?
They just about understand that there has been some, there's been some monkey business between our countries.
Put it lightly.
They just about understand.
I would say in this context, monkey business is a euphemism.
They just about know that there's been some trauma. And there's been a messy breakup. They just about get that. They don't know or care to know the specifics.
Yeah.
But there's just enough surface level understanding for me to play on that relationship. I think for you, the relationship between the Chinese Communist Party and the Taiwanese people is another level of complexity.
It's a lot more intense. So, for example, when we see what happens in Ukraine right now, we will be worried whether Donald Trump will sail Taiwan down the river.
Right.
And there will be an imminent Chinese invasion.
Right.
And even though Irish will complain about Britain, you know, an invasion from the UK is not in sight. And I think that's the main difference.
Exactly right. Exactly right. I think nobody's concerned about...
But I'm still shocked. Maybe I'm surrounded by metropolitan international people in London, but I thought they would have a basic understanding of Britain's colonization of Ireland because Northern Ireland is still there. So surely they would know that. And turns out, not really. You've explained some of them are not vaguely aware that Ireland is a separate independent country, even though that happened more than a century ago.
Yeah, I'm always surprised by that. Always surprised by that because you wouldn't expect, you know, I don't necessarily know the history of Luxembourg, but Ireland doesn't share a land border with Luxembourg.
Yeah.
So it's not even just a point of history or culture. Oftentimes it's a point of geography, you know, it's like they don't necessarily know the geography of their own nation state. Where does the UK end? Where does the Republic begin? Why is it structured that way? People really haven't a clue.
Yeah, because as you describe, what they learn about history is Henry VIII, Winston Churchill, they won the Second World War. They would talk about the war between the white and red roses.
Yeah.
They would spend ages on the kings and queens. But anything slightly murkier about the last century, they don't talk about it much. So from your perspective, it'd be funny because you came here because it's a bigger city, it's a bigger thing. There are more economic activity going on. Mm-hmm. Then you're presented with the sort of geographical, historic ignorance of audience here, then face a choice. Do I just work with it and somehow, or do I find a way to tell them a bit more? And for me personally, if I were to put myself in your shoes, I would find it difficult. Because if you completely ignore it, it might still get you on a wrong day.
Right? Yeah, right.
Like, how could you guys be so ignorant about your own past? You did this. The point I'm trying to make is there are things they don't know well enough. So their attitude, their feedback, does that still bother you?
No, not anymore. I think when I first moved here, I was surprised. But now, you know, the education system is what it is. The culture is what it is. And then you see people like Nigel Farage saying that the curriculum teaches them too much about colonialism and it's too negative on the British Empire. So, you know, and I also accept that Like, I remember school. Mm. You can only teach kids so much. You can't overload them either. But it does surprise me that they voted for Brexit to take back control of their own borders. Mm. And then there was like this multi-year process where they had to figure out what to do with the Northern Irish border.
Or as you say, they would take back control of the border first and work out where the border actually is laid.
Exactly, exactly. So there's a slight, maybe contempt is the wrong word, Republic of Ireland. There's an indifference. It's a small state on the periphery of their island. And they're really not too troubled about what we do or don't do.
I guess what really bothers me and what I'm trying to ask you is, maybe it's, I don't think just because you're Irish, I think it's also because of what you learned. You know more facts to a degree compared to the everyday Joe. But then in comedy, your primary task is to make people laugh. So that means that you have to work with the knowledge level of the general public. Mm-hmm. And that presented me with a dilemma. Because even if I can come to terms with it, when I observe a little comedian just enjoying and keep misleading the public, I'll give you an example. There are so many comedy like to make fun of Germans. When they found out an artist member is from Germany, you know the Nazi joke is coming. You know Anne Frank's diary is coming, right?
That's right.
But they never talk about the British concentration camp in South Africa.
No.
And for me, that's actually hilarious. But I can't make that joke because a lot of people don't know about it, even if international audience. So it's not a level playing field. It's like, it's not only is it so hard, like, do you not even have a look at yourself in the mirror? But all those can only be my monologue, inner thought. They cannot come out because these references are not valid for the audience. And when you're a comedian and the reference don't land, the joke won't land.
That's right.
And that's the problem. Evolve over the years on this relationship between the British audience.
I think when I first moved over here, you know, you're still learning how to do stand-up, really. Mm. I am still learning now today, but at the time I was definitely a lot fresher and I was doing my set. You know, when you first move to a city, you want to do well, so you're just doing your best jokes. So I would do the same jokes that I was doing clubs in Dublin and then doing them in London. And if I perform in central London, east, north London, jokes worked just as well as they had done in Dublin. Then I'd get booked and I would leave London. And this is where kind of I got the idea of the cricket club in Kent. I used that as shorthand for a tough gig outside of London. I would find that the jokes weren't working as well. This is when Brexit was really at the front of the public consciousness. Boris Johnson was in the ascendancy. This was a hot topic. And I would do some of these jokes. I'd often open with these jokes and people would say, well, actually, I voted for Brexit. Or at least 50% of the room voted for Brexit. It was hard. And I remember getting booked for a gig out in like rural Wales. It was a 4-hour journey there and a 4-hour journey back. It was exhausting. And I remember thinking, I can't bomb tonight. I was booked for an opening 20. I was like, I can't bomb. And I walked out. It's in a church hall. I thought, what would Wogan do? What would Terry Wogan do? Because I can't change my act, but I can make them like me. You know, what would I do if I was running for mayor of this little Welsh hamlet? So I went out, there was like, outside the church hall, there was like a parking space that said like vicar. So the vicar had his own parking space. And I just started talking about that. And people found this hilarious. You're an Irish man talking about the local vicar. And then I spoke for 5 minutes, just kind of improvising with them until they liked me. And then I did my jokes. Oh. And then I could say anything because they liked me.
So even though you were doing a slightly pro-Remain point of view, the Brexit voting crowd was still with you.
Because they liked me. But if I went out cold and said, this is what I think about Brexit, that didn't work. But if I was Terry Wogan, if I was the acceptable face of Ireland, poking fun at them a little bit, then they were cool. It's about not coming across as a jerk. It doesn't matter if you're performing to Remainers, Brexiteers. If you come out with a little bit of humility. Let them lower their guards. Like, look, I'm not here to call you stupid. I'm not here to
be condescending.
I'm not here to condescend to you. I'm here to make you laugh. That's a good place for a comedian to start. You're not a journalist. You're not running for local office. You're a comedian. Make them laugh and find a way in.
Do you think the same strategy would have worked for East European with a strong accent? Or is it kind of a thing that's more beneficial to an Irish comedian because you have this sort of blurry place. You can be the acceptable type of Irish and be the less acceptable by the IRA sympathizers, so to speak.
Yeah. Fascinating. But, you know, it's okay to lose an audience as well. I think I'm at the point now where it's like, you know what, I want to be more authentic on stage. And I think in my writing and also like my social media, I've been way more myself. It's true. Myself is interested in colonialism and is interested in history. For every British bulldog in red trousers that doesn't like my stand-up, I am finding other people, British, Irish, American, who enjoy it. Sometimes the hardest thing is to be yourself because we put up so many walls. We're oftentimes doing an impression of what we think a comedian should be, whereas the person who was funny in the pub with their friends, who thought, maybe I could do stand-up, that's actually the funniest person.
This is the amazing moment when your guest did the segue that you were supposed to do. So now that you mentioned social media, okay, I'm going to say that, right? I would describe your stance on social media as constantly poking the bear. That's a quite... You are laughing because you know what I'm saying has an element of truth in it.
Sure.
You adopt a very different stance on social media compared to what you do at a live gig. Is it because social media allows you... At a gig, you have to win over the majority of people on site. On social media, you need to find your audience. You don't have to win over everyone.
Sure.
Do you think that has affected how you pitch your live comedy set and your social media content?
Great question. I think it's true that if in my club set, you play the room that's in front of you.
Yes.
I would like to think that I'm still being myself. Mm-hmm. My attitude with stand-up is you should do the jokes that you and the audience can agree on, right? Yeah. So if I do jokes that only I think are funny, that's going to have a pretty lame outcome for both me and the audience. But if I do jokes that the audience like, but that I don't like, now I'm a hack. Mm. Now I might as well be doing card tricks. But if I do jokes that I think are funny and the audience agree are funny, that's what you want to do.
Yeah, you find a compromise, a balance.
A balance more so than a compromise. Because I don't feel like I'm compromising with... If you come and see me tonight at the Comedy Carnival in Leicester Square, I'm not going to tell one joke that I don't think is funny. I'm confident there's going to be people from the home counties. There are going to be people from the north of England in London for the weekend. There's going to be people from Belgium. There's going to be day trippers from right across Europe and beyond. I'm going to do a set that they're going to enjoy. I'm not going to compromise. I'm still going to be Peter Flanagan. I'm going to give them the hits, you know? Whereas with social media, what's interesting, the first two clips that really did well for me were both jokes that weren't really working on stage. I was very surprised when they did as well as they did. I think that was eye-opening for me because when I'm writing stand-up, very often I think, okay, this is a good joke, this is a good premise, and then I do it on stage and it doesn't really work. Sometimes it doesn't have the cadence of stand-up, or sometimes, as we have just talked about, maybe it's a little observation about Irish history, maybe it's a little bit about cultural colonialism, and sometimes the British audience just don't get it or are not interested. But when I put those routines on social media, the algorithm's a genius. Like, it'll find the people who like that stuff. So I think it's opening up interesting creative possibilities. So it's interesting. I'm still writing how I've always written, but I think I'm finding new vehicles to like get my jokes out there.
I'm not saying that you've compromised your integrity, but let's say I would still give you hits, but you have performed for so many years, so you have a portfolio of hits. So in selecting which one to use, there's a little bit of a choice. For example, if you go to Windsor and you can sense the crowd are a lot of...
Windsor's 50, a really good example, actually.
50 and 60 above women who obviously love and adore the royal family.
Yeah.
Would you still do that?
I have done those jokes in Windsor.
Yeah.
And you have to make a decision as to whether it's worth it.
Did you do it?
Oh, yeah. I've done those jokes in Windsor.
Prince Harry will get his family to kill you and pretend it was a car accident. Would you do that to the women in Windsor?
I've done it. Listen, if they like you, you can sell almost any joke with a big shit-eating grin on your face if you're charming enough and if you're funny enough. But it's 20 minutes. If you've got an hour of material that you know works, like sometimes on a Saturday night, it's easier to just, I'll tell this story about my sex life instead. and everyone will be happy.
Yeah.
You know, and I'll get a drink and I'll get paid and I'll leave. And also, like, why kick Sheila? You know, it's her Saturday night.
Sheila, where's the soup? I sang this jingle the other day. Half of the room didn't recognize it.
Really?
Yeah.
I think that's what I'm learning with the social media and even the newspaper writing is like, be yourself, be authentic.
To a point. That's why I would pretty take it in a cower way. Be myself to a point.
Yeah. But you know, the stuff that resonates with people, like,
you may not know because you are a nice person. What if the other person themselves just. do you know what I mean? The last question I would like to end on is you touch upon something I've observed, and I've referenced this many times on this podcast with different guests, but I didn't phrase it the way like you did. The divide between urban, city dweller, city comedy, and rural comedy. Mm-hmm. I think I tend to put it as in people who have a bit more international outlook, who are more interested in foreign cultures and cross-cultural experiences. But that's pretty much down to the same thing. You are a well-traveled person. You came to London. You then went to Australia. Is it right? You went to Dubai as well?
Yeah.
So you've been to different places. I say you did the most Irish thing. You left. But not every Irish person that left went to multiple places and traveled the world around. You did. You then described on another podcast that sort of how at ease and you feel the audience gets you if you do a gig in East London, half the crowd may not from here. So there's a amalgamation of points of views and different cultures where you go to quite a sort of monolithic culture, as it said, like 1 hour away from London, you're in Northampton or the Kent Cricket Club.
That's right.
So you realize the world now, there's a greater divide between the rural dwellers and city dwellers work.
Sure.
But I guess the question, if I sort of condense into a simple question, is that you've realized they are gigs. They are not naturally, I would say not your crowd, but they don't warm up to you that easily. Hmm. Would you deliberately keep a percentage of those gigs you must go? To just to train you all your life.
Self-harm.
Or it's all down to how much each venue pays and minus the travel expense. Do you know what I mean? Like,
no, sure.
Some people would think I have to be outside this comfortable environment just to make myself a better comedian. Some bye-bye. I am not quite that, but I will still go.
Yeah.
But I don't force myself to go to gigs where the audience don't warm up to
me. I've been doing stand-up long enough that I'm not really a martyr for it anymore. So if I'm offered a gig in Portsmouth for £100 on a Tuesday, I'm probably not going to go.
Mm.
I'm probably
150.
So I prefer to gig in London just because it means I can sleep in my own bed that night.
Yes.
However, I hope I never think I'm too good to go perform in a small town. I'm from a small town in Ireland. You know, I'm not urbane and cool. I grew up in a small town. I'm from a rural background. I like small towns. So I want to.
Would you work in a way you look at your diary and for the past 3 months, you've not set foot outside London once? Would you start to think that maybe I should get a London bit more?
I think so. There's some comics, not only do they not leave London, sometimes they don't leave a particular club.
Islington.
There's some comics who smash a gig in Islington, but then if they go and do a gig in Covent Garden, the audience is too broad. So I always encourage people, don't get stuck in playing one club. Play more than one club. And if you leave London, for better or for worse, those are the people who live in England.
Yeah.
You live in Great Britain. These are the people who live in Great Britain. These are the people who, if you want to put on a tour, are the people who live in this country. So go and perform to them. See what they find funny. See what you can agree on.
And apart from the view on British colonization, big difference between Irish crowds and British crowds?
Irish crowds can be a bit chattier. Hmm? So I've heard it described as them being like a Liverpool crowd. I haven't really gigged in Liverpool, but I understand it's very, Scouse is very culturally Irish and or similar, at least in aspects. But an Irish person thinks they're funny, right? An Irish person instinctively thinks they have great stories and has great banter.
So you better prove that you're better than me.
Or they kind of want to be part of the show. That's one thing I will say. So if you look at a lot of Irish comics who start in Dublin, like I really kind of cut my teeth in like the International Bar in Dublin, and the International Bar until recently didn't have a mic. So you would go in there on a Friday night.
Is it deliberate?
Oh, yeah. Oh. There's no microphone. It's a narrow space. On a Friday night, they would oversell the tickets, about 90 people in a 70-seat room. So they're sitting people on the stage to your left or to your right,
yeah.
And it's packed. And there's no security. The MC introduces you and leaves the room. And then you're left alone in the room with 90 people, literally heaving with people. They all have pints in their hands. And you shout at them to get your point of view across. So there's a lot of Irish comics who start in Dublin who have a very similar delivery mechanism, because you learn to shout and you also learn to interact. There's a lot of crowd work in Irish comedy. If you're not funny, people are thinking, well, I'm funny. You know, my friend is funny. Maybe we'll chat amongst ourselves, or maybe we'll interject into your act and get involved. It's not necessarily malicious, but Irish people think they're funny.
So you are not going on tour yet, but I think it will happen very soon.
I hope so, man.
Right.
Thank you.
So how do people find your on social media?
So I'm on Facebook, I'm on TikTok, I'm on Instagram. It's Peter Flanagan Comedy. Please give me a follow and come to a show.
Yeah, Peter Flanagan Comedy, because if you Google Peter Flanagan, there are a lot of them.
There's a few. There's a hurley maker. Hurling is an Irish sport with the bats.
Oh, yes, with the...
The wooden sticks. Yeah, the bats.
No, the spoon. Spatula. I call that a spatula.
It's a hurl.
I went to Kilkenny.
A hurley bat.
I saw people walking around there. I was like, is there a baking contest?
My father's called Peter Flanagan. You can find his business in Kildare. There is the business journalist, Peter Flanagan.
Assistant business editor.
Assistant business editor, yeah. There's a few of us. There's a few of us, man, yeah. So check them all out.
Okay, so that's my first and probably won't be the last guest from Ireland today. Peter Flanagan, thank you for coming today.
Cheers, man.
We're going to go out and enjoy the sunshine. See you guys. Ciao.